This is the first provocative play of the season, and I'm all glad that you can be here this evening. This play was chosen for this Friday by Norm and me because it's the week of July 4th, and it is a play that is in keeping with the theme of America and what America means, and it's a play that we think you will find, we hope you will find enjoyable. And if you find it interesting enough to want to talk about some of the things that come to mind as you were listening to it after it's over, we invite you to stay for a brief discussion afterward. If you're satisfied and just want to leave, that's fine too. My name is Ruth Schultz, and I would like, before I say any more about the play, to introduce my cast to you this evening. On my right is Mike Sharp, Dee Bechtel, Marilyn Scott, Betsy Henderson, Lois Beckemeyer, Roy Satry, Bob Hamilton, Alan Adams, and Colleen Nelson. And we will share the play with you. Strictly speaking, this is not a play. This is an adaptation of a book by Studs Terkel called American Dreams, Lost and Found. I think that in the year 4000 something, when people, archaeologists, are searching for the remnants of the great civilization of America, and they come upon the books of Studs Terkel, and I have the question in their minds, what were the Americans like? That when they find Studs Terkel's books, they will find very much about what Americans were like, at least in the 20th century. And I think there's no need to say any more about it. We'll simply begin. A while back, I was traveling through Europe and Asia. It seemed like everywhere I went, I was asked the same question. What's it like to live in America? It must be wonderful. America has everything. You can do or say or be anything. Well, sort of got me to thinking, you know. America, land of the free, home of the brave, land of opportunity. We've said and heard these things all our lives, and I suppose it's all true. But with all our freedom and opportunity, what's becoming of America? The American dream, what is it? We began pretty well here in America, didn't we? When you think of all the promise of this country, I don't see how we could have found much greater promise or a greater beginning. Statue in the harbor inviting wretched masses. And the masses came like waves of the sea, thousands and thousands of people seeking freedom. They came to a land by nature and by industry blessed to make it, to escape. They all came with a...
All my life, I've been thinking, come to this country for what I read in magazines and movies. Lisbeth Taylor, Vivian Leigh, Oliver de Havilland, Clark Gable. I would have beautiful castle in United States. I will have 1,000 servants. I will have Rolls Royces at my door. You know all these kind of movies, beautiful houses, beautiful dresses, money, cars. Be thinking everybody have this kind of life. I have this dream. America was something like Happy Land someplace. Far beyond the mountains, overseas. America was the best. America was something where everybody would like to be. I always love to come to the States. just to be free, just to be me.
The dream to me was to be tall, blonde, and able to disappear. See, growing up in Hollywood was the only reality I knew. Closest thing I ever got to feeling glamorous was from my mother's maid, a woman named Dorothy, who used to call me Glamour. She was black. Well, in those days she was called colored. My mother was of upper class Jewish immigrants. They lost everything in the Depression. My father tried to do everything he could to revive my mother's idea of what life had been like for her father in the court of the Tsar. Whether her father was ever actually in the court was irrelevant. My father tried to make it classy for her. Never was good enough. Never could be. She couldn't be a Boston Brahmin. Consequently, I loved movies about boys running away to sea. I wanted to be the laconic, cool, tall, male Aryan. Precisely the opposite of an angry, anxious, sort of mottled-haired Jewish girl. I wanted to be this guy who could walk away from responsibility. The American dream, the idea of the happy ending, it's an avoidance of responsibility and commitment. If something ends happily, you don't have to worry about it tomorrow. The happy ending was the invention of Russian Jews, designed to drive Americans crazy. The idea of the movie star, that perfect-looking woman or man who has breakfast at a glass table on a terrace where there are no mosquitoes. No one ever went to the bathroom in the movies. So I grew up thinking movie stars didn't. I thought it was terrible to be a regular human being. Movie stars don't look awful, ever. They don't throw up. They never get really sick. Except in that wonderful way where they get a sort of a gloss, little bit of sweat on the forehead, and then they die. They didn't shrivel or shrink away, and they didn't have acne. And the women didn't have menstrual cramps. Sex, when I ran across it, in no way resembled anything I'd ever seen in the movies. I didn't know how to respond. I think the reason we're so crazy sexually in America is that all our responses are acting. We don't know how to feel. We only know how it looked in the movies. We know that in the movies it's inconceivable that the bad guy will die. Therefore, we don't get terribly involved in any cause. Good guys are going to win anyway. It's a marvelous political weapon. My illusions disappeared when I began to be a writer and had to look at the reality. I never learned it from psychiatrists. See, the American dream is really money. When it finally sunk in that I was going to have to support two children, terrifying. I think the snake in the Garden of Eden was my growing awareness. The reality was there, but I chose not to see it. The thing that terrified me most was my own intelligence and power of observation. The more I saw, the more I tried not to see. So I drank too much, and I took as many drugs as I could so as not to see. Couldn't bear it, the reality. Couldn't bear to feel my father was wrong. couldn't bear the idea that it was not the best of all possible worlds. Couldn't bear the idea there was a living to be made, that punishment does not always come to those who deserve it, and that good people do die in the end. I remember lying in my bed in that beautiful castle house in the Hollywood Hills. All through the windows, I could see this cloud of jacaranda trees with their purple flowers, and the sun was shining. And then my husband called and said President Kennedy had been shot and killed. They made a movie of Kennedy being shot, and they kept playing it over and over again on the television. And I kept watching it, like every other American, hoping this time the ending would be different. Why did we watch it day after day after day, if not to see that maybe the ending was going to be different? Maybe they'll do it right this time. But they couldn't retake it. The triumph of the small man. That was another wonderful Hollywood myth. Very popular in the mid-40s. Well, once that dream went, once that illusion went, we all began to suspect what was really going on. Once we became conscious, that was the snake. It was the awareness of power, awareness that war was not a parade, awareness of reality. The Hollywood dream has driven us crazy, but no more than any other mythology. Religious orders that govern whole states, decide what they should believe, Greek and Roman gods and goddesses, Catholicism. Hollywood is just another draft, a more polished version. What else are we going to live by, if not by dreams? We need to believe in something. What would really drive us crazy is to believe this reality we run into every day is all there is. If I don't believe there's that happy ending out there, that will you marry me in the sky? I can't keep working today. That's true, I think, for all of us.
The day I won the Miss USA pageant, I started to laugh. They tell me that I'm the only beauty queen in history that didn't cry when she won. It was on network television, and I said to myself, "You're kidding." Bob Barker, the host, said, "No, I'm not kidding." I didn't know what else to say at that moment. In the press releases, they tell you it's the great, they call it the great American dream. There she is, Miss America. Your ideal. Well, that's not my ideal, kid. The minute you're crowned, you become their property and subject to whatever they tell you. You wake up at 7 o'clock the next morning and you put on your negligee, and they serve you breakfast in bed so that all the New York papers can come and take your picture sitting in bed while you're absolutely bleary-eyed from the night before. They put on the Kaiser Roth negligee, hand you a tray, and you take 3 bites. The photographers leave. They whip off the negligee, they take the breakfast away, and that's it. I never did get any breakfast that day. You immediately start making personal appearances. The JCs, the Chamber of Commerce, the United Fund. You get your salary. That's your prize money for the year. I got $15,000, which is all taxed in New York. Maybe out of a check of $3,000, I'd get $1,500 to keep. Now, from the day I won the Miss America to the day I left for Universe, almost 2 months, I got a day and a half off. I had made about 250 personal appearances, maybe even 300. There were parades, shopping centers, and things like that, snip the ribbons. And the nice thing I got to do was public speaking. They said, "You want a ghostwriter?" I said, "Hell no, I know how to talk." So I wrote my own speeches. Apparently they don't trust girls to go out and talk because I guess most of them can't. One of the big execs one time asked me to do a speech in Washington, D.C. on the consumer and energy crisis. It was the 50th anniversary of the National Management Association. And the White House, for some reason, sent me some stuff on it. And I read it over, but it was pure nonsense. And so I stood up and said, "The reason we have an energy crisis is because we are industrially and personally pigs. We have a short-term view of the resources available to us, and unless we wake up to what we're doing to our air and to our water, we'll have a dearth and not just a crisis." They weren't very pleased. What I resent most is that a lot of people did not expect me to live this version of the American dream for myself. I was supposed to live it their way. Well, by the end of the year, you're run absolutely ragged. That final evening, they usually have several queens from past years come back. And then before they crown the new Miss USA, the current one is supposed to take what they call the farewell walk. They call over the PA system, "Time for the old queen's walk." Now, I was 23, and I'm an old queen. And they have this idiot farewell speech playing over the airwaves as the old queen takes her walk. And you're sitting on the throne for about 30 seconds. And then you come down, and they announce the name of the new one, and you put the crown on her head, and then you're out. As the new one is crowned, the reporters and the photographers rush on the stage. Now, I have seen photographers shove the girl who has just given up her reign 30 seconds before. Just shove her physically. But I was gone by that time. I had jumped off the stage in my evening gown. It's very difficult for girls who are terrified of this type of ending. All of a sudden, you're out. And nobody gives a damn about the old one. Miss USA and remnants thereof is the crown that's stored in the attic in my parents' home. I don't even know where the banners are. It wasn't me the fans of Miss USA thought was pretty. What they think is pretty is the banner and the crown. Now, if I could put that banner and that crown on that microphone, I swear to God, 10 men would come in and ask it for a date. And I'll think about committing an axe murder if I'm not called anything except a former beauty queen. I can't stand it anymore. Now, you know, several times during my year as What's-Her-Face, I had seen the movie The Sting. And there's a gesture that the characters use when the con is on. They rub their nose. Now, in my last fleeting moments as Miss USA, as they were playing that silly farewell speech, and I walked down the aisle and I stood by the throne, I looked right into the camera and I rubbed my nose. Well, the next day, the pageant people spent all their time telling people that I hadn't done it. And I spent the time telling them that of course I had. I simply meant, the con is on. I always wanted to be rich, and I really didn't care how. Just to have a lot of money, because we never had a lot. You always want what you don't have. The American dream is good. It's one of the things that keep people going. Anybody can do it, can make it. If you didn't have your dream, you just give up. People have always got this great idea that's going to hit. You know they're never going to make it, but the dream keeps them alive. My husband's younger brother is like that. He's always got a scheme. Tomorrow he's going to be a millionaire. If he ever lost that, there would be nothing left. Everything came easily to him. He always just kind of fell into things. He was the golden-haired boy. He was the one that had everything. Everybody liked him. He had a way with words and could get most anything out of anybody. He told my husband, in the chess game of life, I'm two moves away from making it. He picked it up from one of those success magazines. He subscribes to them. He sees them advertised on TV, how to become a millionaire in 20 days or something. I'm afraid that one of these days, he's going to become very embittered. My husband thinks he's getting really paranoid about them. He's very right-wing, very anti-communist, very anti-government, very, very anti-black. In the last few years, you can see the hate coming in. We get together and have these big political arguments. It used to be a lot of fun, but in later years, it got to the point where he'd be so far out in left field that you couldn't talk to him. He was almost at the point of grabbing a gun and shooting people down himself. It just got to the point where my husband would tell him, I don't want to argue anymore. All we do is get angry. He has almost like a small arsenal in his home. He always wants to show you his guns. He had an M1 or something, some big gun. He said, it's ready to go. I said, what do you want one of those for? He said, when they come, I'm going to be ready. I said, Who are you talking about? What's going to happen is, when your kids get a little older and they go out on a date and they come home, you're going to shoot one of your kids. But he's ready for them whenever they come. He tries to be perfect, a perfect parent in an odd way. I can't describe it. The kids have turned out to be very unnatural. They're not spontaneous. They're almost programmed. His wife is a very good person. She just works round the clock. At the beginning, she used to keep him pretty straight, but she's gotten to the point where she goes along with his thinking, even with the guns. Scares the hell out of me. I said I wanted to be rich. If I wanted to make a lot of money, I'd rob a bank. If I thought I could get away with it. You're always rooting for the bad guy, as long as he's not really bad. That doesn't hurt anybody. You think, oh God, let him get away. What the heck? Somebody else can pay for whatever he steals. There's a lot of people. There's a side of people. Corruption is a way of life. The games you have to play sometimes just to survive. There are things that you do. My husband and I were speeding. We got stopped. The officer took his driver's license. Jack went to him and said, I know I was speeding, but we were really in a hurry and running late. I'm an alderman. The cop gave him everything back and said, better watch it. We didn't get the ticket. I said, you were wrong and you really should be punished. Jack said, I know, but that's one of the games of life. Oh, I just said a double thing. I said that I would rob a bank, and then I said I hate corruption. Jekyll and Hyde. I would like to see a time when nobody, it sounds kind of like a communist state, huh? But when nobody was without, that would be nice to see, you know? I'd like to have a lot of money, but when I see people that are very poor, it's unsettling to me. I just think, if I had a lot of money, I couldn't really enjoy it when all these people are like this.
I didn't learn about America in school. I learned what they wanted me to learn. What I feel about America, I learned on my own. In school, everything was just great. We never did anything wrong. Everything was justified. And up until I was 13, I believed that. After that, I turned myself off, and from then on, it was my own opinion. I'd like to be a writer or do some kind of social work. A house in the suburbs just isn't for me. The PTA and the carpool and the house with the mortgage, that doesn't appeal to me. I don't want to be 30 years old with three kids in my Maytag. I'd go crazy. I think for my father and his generation, the dream was to have a home and security and things like that. It was because of the poverty they came from. I don't know what it is now. The kids I go to school with, when they talk about their dreams, they don't talk about a home and having money in the bank. It's more like trying to have personal satisfaction. They don't know what they want. I don't know what I want. I don't know what my dreams are. There's so many things I'd like to do. I would like to go to college and do something, really contribute something. But I look at my neighborhood and my friends and my family and I think, me going to college and being a writer, that would separate me from them. I would feel like I was breaking away, like I couldn't come back and sit on the front porch with my friends. It wouldn't be the same. I'd be the outcast. Every day I wake up, oh, I'll go to college. The next day, no, I'm not. I'm going to get a job when I graduate. So I don't know. You see, other people I know went on to college, come back to the neighborhood in the summer to visit their friends. We're sitting around talking and feeling different. They treat them differently. It's not really resentment. More like envy. They can't just goof off with them anymore, and it's sad to me. I wouldn't want them to act like I wasn't their friend anymore. The few we knew that have been to college, some of them do feel superior and look down on the neighborhood. They're ashamed to tell people where they live. See, it's a bad neighborhood where I live, but it's where I live. It's my home, and I'm not ashamed. Tech Lane, where I go, is a mixture. It's working class, and there are also a lot of wealthy people. It's too large, and it's not a happy place. The rich kids have their things, their Gucci shoes and their Marshall Field clothes, and they sit in their part, and we sit in ours. We're just acquaintances. There's a few black kids, and they're welcome, but they don't want to be with us. We leave each other alone. We're all like separated. I feel old. To me, every day is a day gone, whether you're 5, 10, or 16. That's 16 years that are gone now. I don't worry about getting physically old. That doesn't bother me. Just not accomplishing anything and getting old, that bothers me. What have I done in all these 16 years? 16 years is a long time to be alive and not really doing anything but going to school. There's so many things I'd like to do.
To me, the mountains here, it's been kind of a wild animal refuge for people. I don't think the people here know the history of Appalachia. They don't know much about the history of this country. As far as that goes, the school system has failed. It's been dead for 100 years. When I was small, environment was important to me. I missed school because I wanted to kick around in the mountains. I was watching the game. I was in the rivers and the streams. I didn't have time to go to school because I could read a book in 10 minutes, and the teacher's talk was like a preacher's. I heard 100 preachers, and they preach the same tune all the way. Just not got time to tolerate that. I want to live 30 years, and every year I'm going to try to live 30 years. Life is short as it is. It took me 50 years making about face and realize who I was and what I was doing. What I was taught was a Mickey Mouse world, make-believe thing. I knew nothing about a broad form deed until 15 years ago. Knew nothing about the trail of tears. Our schools tell us nothing about this. Where I really needed an education is when a highly skilled, educated man is shooting his mouth and knocking me down with some goddamn big words that I don't understand, and the skillful way that he does it is I know nothing about. That's a place that I could like to have a good education so I could knock him down. Actually, I think I'd probably like to be a lawyer. Like to know the law of the land, because all my life people have been denied their rights. Still on my mind. We've got highly educated people. I guess that's something that I wanted to be. I wanted to be part of helping somebody one way or another. People here, they're living on the richest natural resources in the world, and yet they get no part of it. People here, never been educated, didn't know how to read or write, and signed with an X, a contract known as a broad form deed. Industry bought the rights of what they called natural gas and timber for 25 cents an acre. Children and the grandchildren of these broad form recipients, they thought they owed the land. You know that song? You know that song? This land is your land. There's a legal device that says it's not your land. As long as it's like that, as long as we get a Mickey Mouse education system that doesn't teach us how things work, how the government works, who runs it, it's going to be trouble here. Ever since I was a little boy, my father said, we can't survive in this community if we don't learn to keep our mouths shut. My father was scared. He needed a job, he had a family. That's what's wrong with this country. We're all running scared. But take this young fellow just back from Vietnam. His land was being destroyed by strip miners. His lawyers said, You ain't got a chance. All the court officials is in the coal business. He got all kinds of citations for killing people he didn't even know, and he runs into this. He's getting a new education, and he's getting it the hard way. Lots of young people seeing it like this. I don't know if this thing in Appalachia can be settled without violence or not. I hope it can. I was taught to recognize the American flag, to pledge allegiance, to serve in the Navy, and to do my part, but now with the bulldozers, I just don't believe poor people is going to sit around and take it. People can't run scared. If they do, they might as well end it right now. I don't want violence. People here got a reason to be violent. These hills weren't here to be torn all to hell by bulldozers and greedy people. I saw the deer go, and I saw the beaver go, and I saw the fish go, and I saw the game go, and I saw all the streams go, and I'm beginning to see the people go. And all this can happen in my 60 years. You wonder where it's going to end. But you don't give up. Because a handful of people can win this country. Handful of people in the beginning saved this country. They did the fighting while 3/4 of them, by God, just sat by and watched it. You don't need an army. You don't need 10,000 people. You just need a few people who are determined to win.
I'm a traveling folk singer, and I love the feeling of the country and of the land as I pass through it. Think of the town I grew up in, Boise, Idaho, as I move around, and of my family and how they got there, and of my own sense of place. My grandparents were an adventurous people. Grandpa was a preacher. He wouldn't live with the Indians. So he went west, across the Badlands, all by himself in 1900. There's pictures of the first trek. Great long trek with pack horses, all strung out across the field. And later, when he became a pastor of a church in Haley, Idaho, he used to snowshoe from Haley all the way up to Ketchum to preach a sermon in a little church there. He turned that church into a bar now. I sang here a little while back. As a traveling folk singer, I miss my own sense of place. There's a terrible mobility in society today. It's too easy to run away from things. And I do that too. These with which you can shift the ground makes the land fall away from under you all the time. The sense of being someplace disappears faster every year. Home, Boise, hardly exists for me anymore. All the things I remember with pleasure have been torn down, replaced by bullshit. They want to make a mall out of downtown Boise, all covered like a cattle chute for consumers. Boise is a corruption of the forest trees. Used to be a little cup of trees, corridors of green. Trees so old and big that came together, formed little corridors, stop. It's against the law to shoot a squirrel. They cut down the trees, tore down the old houses. Things I remember with pleasure, they're all gone now. Sense of community. As a kid in Boise, I was always a misfit at school. I didn't relate well to the kids because I could read faster than any of them. They had these reading tests in third grade. I made real high grades. I didn't think I was much smarter than anybody else. I just always read a lot. Anyway, one day four big guys, He knocked me down and told me I shouldn't get such good scores anymore. Like some kind of a kid mafia. I still think about that. I hadn't got over the idea that somebody could do something like that to another person just because that person was winning. Their sense was that I was winning. My sense was that I wasn't competing. I'm just a traveling folk singer. I do what I do. I'm not trying to beat anybody out. It seems awful to me that anybody bases their whole life on winning. I always loved that song, Malvina Reynolds says, "I don't mind wearing raggedy breeches. Those who succeed are sons of bitches. I don't mind failing in this land." And there's another line. "I'll stay down here with a raggedy crew if getting up there means stepping on you." I don't have any money, but I'm given love by my audiences, and I make enough money to get along. I've been very lucky in the friends that have come to me, and I consider myself to be incredibly successful. See, the men in my family were disasters of the Depression. My daddy never learned how to make money and be successful, but I always thought of my dad as a success because he was just a wonderful man. My memories of him are all delightful because he seemed so particular. He wasn't like nobody else. My daddy liked words, and he taught me to. He taught me all the soliloquies from Hamlet when I was a little big boy. He'd say the words are like music, and I would come to understand them. Paul loved to tell stories and turn me on to those things. I think it's because of him I began to write and collect songs. I repeat old songs that I hear. I have this big repertoire of songs that nobody else knows. When my daddy died, I remember this real turkey. Real turkey from a funeral home. He gives us this line about how cheap we are because we don't want to buy an expensive coffin. "We're going to have a cremation and take Dad's ashes up and put them at the cabin where he lived." This guy says, "What florist do you want us to call?" I said, "We're going to bring some pine boughs and weeds from the other cabins." He said, "Well, one of our services is to write the obituary. Tell me something about him." I'm looking at this guy and I can't think of anything. He said, "What was his religion?" I said, "Well, he wasn't very religious." He says, "Well, what did he do for a living?" I said, "He hadn't worked in a long time." I thought, I'm not going to say anything. I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, my daddy could walk for 2 blocks on his hands. People would come by and would say, "Good morning," as though they were just a regular way to be walking along. He used to jump over a card table from a standing jump every year on his birthday. I think Daddy was 56 when he missed. Paul missed that day. But he had this piece of land. He built this beautiful house. He cut every tree. Every one of them. And that bush, as if it grew right out of the ground. Daddy went hunting all the time, too. He loved to walk through the woods making up dirty limericks. But he knew the name of every bird and every flower. How do you describe a man like that? He wasn't like anybody else in this world. He didn't have the same dreams as most people. He didn't fit their mold. So I didn't say anything to that man at the funeral home. I just said, I can't think of anything to tell you about my father that you'd like to hear.
When I was 14, I wrote this poem. It goes, I am not a child of my mother, nor of God, but a child of my own. I live not of the soil or sod, a child of independence, no one holds my hand, a child not of this earth, nor belonging to this land. Rose the ganglier, that was me. Unbelievable. I was kicked out of high school, so I didn't finish eighth grade. I was a problem. But I didn't want to go anyway. What was I learning? There was no challenge. They teach you how to conform, to pledge allegiance, to sing God Bless America. What is America? You tell me. Is it the two-car garage, the 2.5 children, trees all the same size? Never forget, my dad and Uncle Chuck decided to tell us what America was. We had a guy named Nicky who didn't want to go into the army. Oh man, I thought we were going to have a war in the living room. My uncle yelling and screaming and jumping about how he jumped out of airplanes and got shot, and this guy Nicky still just rocking in the rocking chair, saying, I don't want to do that. They told him he was a communist. They'd had a few drinks, and they get out Karl Marx. And they start reading passages and saying to him, do you know what this means? He said, no. Still kept rocking. I looked down at the picture of Karl Marx, and oh my God, it looks just like my Uncle Chuck. Be quiet, Nicky says, or they'll bomb you too. Then I find out that Uncle Chuck was in the service, but he never fought. He played guitar all through the war. It was a strange night. I had an argument with my mother, too. She said, there's a solution for the whole thing. A problem kid, put it away. A problem country, bomb it into the ocean. There was a lot of fear she had. I think a lot of fear. The things she feared were in herself, and they were coming out in her children. You know, if you don't do what somebody tells you, you're a problem. You're a great crime. You're incorrigible. 13 years ago, I didn't think God and I were traveling the same road. I never thought I'd find a place to belong to in this world. And there was our street gang. We learned where our place was supposed to be. Nowhere. We were told we were bums. Teachers, parents, police, neighbors yelling, get off the corner, you don't belong here. We grew up believing that. Well, I don't have to believe that anymore. I'm a counselor at Uptown. From leader of the problem to dealer of the problem. It's a long way. And I'm going back to school at 29. It's not that I want an education to be successful, but I just can't do nothing. And I have a place here. I feel needed. You know, my mother recently told me she was proud of me. I waited 29 years to hear her say that. She called up recently and wanted to know if I could help her. I could help her. That was a complete turnabout. I think she's questioning, for the first time in her life. She wakes up, she's 53, and says, "Who needs me anymore? They're all gone." It's important to feel needed. A child of independence, no one holds my hand. Now I think we're all connected. I think I must have found my place, my connection.
I don't remember dreams when I was a child. Our dream was to get through the week until payday. We were poor white sharecroppers. We picked cotton for a living. No one gave us any reason to dream. The grown-ups had no dreams, so they couldn't pass any on to their children. We were Irish. If any race was meant to be dreamers, I think it's the Irish. What makes me sad is that none of the Irish I know had any dreams. All we thought about was picking cotton. From sun up to way late at night. I can remember when we were picking cotton. We could look over the field and see the black people over there picking cotton. They were niggers. They had nothing to do with me, which is exactly what the owners of the plantations wanted. They really did a good job on us. You're so busy hating somebody else, you're not going to realize you how beautiful you are and how much you destroy all that's good in the world. I was always calling myself Anglo-Saxon. My mother says, "You're not Anglo-Saxon, you're a Celt." So I had to find out what that was because I didn't want to be black or Indian or God knows what. I wanted to be Anglo-Saxon. Really, though, despite the race hatred between us, there's no difference between Southern whites and Southern blacks in what sends us up north. Lack of jobs. We get hungry, and we get scared, and we want a better way of life. There's where the dreams come in. I don't know a single Southerner that would be up north, black or white, if there was work down there. At 15, I worked my way up to Chicago from Montgomery. Poor Southerners are as lost and bewildered when they come to Chicago as anybody from Germany or Italy or Poland. It's like we come from a foreign country. We lose our way in subways, and we don't know about addresses. Down home, we say somebody lives down at the bend of the road, or halfway down by an old maple tree. It doesn't work that way in Chicago. In Chicago, quite a while after I got there, after I was married, I met this black woman, Emma Tiller. She was a friend of my husband's. He was going to bring her home for supper. I told him I wasn't going to cook dinner for a nigger. He said, "If you don't want to treat my friends decent, I'm going to stop treating yours decent." I decided I better keep peace in the family. Straighten up a little bit. So she came to dinner. He went out in the hall and helped her off with her galoshes. I'll never forget that. I thought, my God, that's just terrible. Time passed, though. And as he rocked along, I got kind of used to her. Without ever realizing it, I started learning from her and saw how much we were alike. She told me when she first came to Chicago from Texas, she went to an employment office. All her life, she'd been led to believe that all white people could read and write. She ran into this girl who asked her to help fill out the employment form. Emma said she was dumbfounded. The girl couldn't read or write, and she was white. This is one of the things started me listening to her. In my own family, there are people who can't read or write. Well now, one day that march on Washington came, I got on the train with Emma and went. After I learned all that from her about blacks, then I had to learn to let my feelings spill over to my own people. Before, I had been this great white and I had quit kicking blacks. But I didn't want nothing to do with hillbillies. You don't go organize people just like you, people you want to get away from, for God's sake. I tell you, when I started organizing poor whites, I never knew I could care so much about Southerners, about poor whites. When I began organizing, I started out by just talking to groups of women. We talked about things that were hurting us. Out of the coal mines with black lung, or out of whatever poor Southern whites were making their living. I think we hillbillies got together on this playground for the kids. Uptown was a hillbilly ghetto. There wasn't any place for the kids to play on except the street. At least twice a month, a child was struck by a car. A crowd of women went to the park officials. They told us that black people were tearing up the city and they spent all their money pacifying them, and so they didn't have no more money. Using that racism again, this very quiet little hillbilly woman, no bigger than a bar of soap after a hard day's work, she stood up. And she was so mad. And she said, what you're telling us is niggers are raising hell for their rights and you give them all the money and there's none for us. If that's what it takes, us hillbillies can work up a real good right. Uptown was a different place after we were there. We got our playground and a lot of other things, and it was worth the battle. Many of the people we organized are in other places doing things now. Those women will never be the same. One of the white women who had been a racist, she's in Georgia now. When they closed the dress factory she worked in up north, she and other white women joined with black women and bought into a shop together. Now I'm full of dreams, a million. My dreams are gigantic. When I saw the Japanese farmers on television fighting to stop that airport, I felt I was one of them. I said, right on! I think of all the races of people, and I want to be friends with them. Now I have so much hope. The reason is, I know darn well if I could start out the ignoramus I was and full of hate, then anybody is capable of finding out the same darn things I did. It's no big secret. Everybody's capable of the same thing. It's just something has to touch you, and suddenly you realize what it boils down to. Me? I think it's all about believing everybody should be sir or ma'am.
I'm an optimist. Couldn't be a political organizer if I was a pessimist.
I truly believe that human beings have got common sense. If someone's told the fact, common sense will prevail. I'm not asking anybody to trust me or to believe in me. I'm asking them to question themselves. You know, we're told some issues are too complex for ordinary people. Well, I say bullshit. It's the best argument to delude the people. The same thing we heard about the Vietnam War. If we're going to have a democracy in this country, by God, we're going to have to start telling the people the facts. Einstein said it 30 years ago. We must take the facts about nuclear power to the village square, and from the village square must come America's voice. I grew up in a village square, so to speak. See, experts always talk in technical terms. People haven't been able to understand them, so they've turned them off. The media is selling us on the notion of apathy and paralysis in the country. Bullshit. Movements haven't died. They've done the most intelligent thing they could have done. They went to find homes in communities. They're working. They're working unnoticed in the neighborhood. They're starting to blossom and to make connections. I've been all over this country, and I've not been into one community where I did not find the people exactly like me. If there's ever going to be a change in America, it's going to be because every community in America is ready for it. And then, boom, there's going to be a great big tidal wave, and it's just going to crash down on Washington, D.C. And the people are finally going to be heard.